But first, it's a bit of a grand occasion tonight. The London studios of the ABC have been, well, not so much in lockdown as we've been in locked out. They've been locked and the key was thrown away, and tonight is the first time the London studio has been used in years, and it's wholly appropriate that on this splendid occasion we're talking to the marvellous Ian Dunt. And Ian, of course, is a columnist with the I newspaper. Ian, I would like to dally a little on the latest sex scandal with the Conservative Party, but we've got to go back to Brexit and Ireland. Would you tell us the significance of the Sinn Féin victory?
Huge. I mean, we've never had the nationalist side take the First Minister position. That is now where we are. But of course, it has been almost instantly detonated by the DUP. The Unionist Party came a very disappointing second, their vote collapsing in on itself. And yet, they are able to essentially eradicate the government by saying, look, we're not going to serve as second minister. Up until now, they've always been first minister. They always came first in the polls. Now they're saying, well, if it's second minister, we're not going to take it. That is a way of essentially saying the government will not stand, no government will be formed, because you need both sides of the divide in Northern Ireland in order to be able to form a legitimate government. That has then thrown the ball over to number 10 in London, to Downing Street, because they are suddenly very, very open to doing whatever the DUP demands of them, despite the fact that the DUP did not win the election. And what the DUP demands is that Britain detonates the Northern Irish Protocol agreement that it signed with the EU. So from this Sinn Féin victory, we've had this domino effect towards this international dispute.
As the wonderful Fintan O'Toole said recently, the DUP is no longer first among equals, and they're not very happy.
No, I mean, I think as I said this to you last time, but really it's quite hard to think of any organisation or individual that has self-sabotaged as hard as the DUP, because they pushed for this process as far as it could go. They pushed for it and pushed for it and pushed for it for Brexit, then harder Brexit. And then eventually they found themselves with an arrangement where there was a border put between the British mainland and Northern Ireland, the exact reverse of their entire existential agenda. So they do deserve, it has to be said, absolutely everything that's coming to them at the moment, but they do have this one key strength, which is that their interest in dismantling the Northern Ireland Protocol chimes with the interest of Downing Street in doing it. Why is Downing Street interested in doing this? It's because it puts a clear dividing line between the Tory Party and Keir Starmer for Labour. It's their chance to just take some of those scabs from the Brexit war and just pull on them and pull on them and see if they can make them bleed again to try and repair the electoral coalition that they had back in 2019. So really, none of this is an assessment of a protocol. None of this is certainly not an assessment of the electoral results that we saw in the Northern Irish Assembly. All of it is a very tawdry and short-termist approach towards their internal electoral calculations.
We're being blunt with Dunt. The recent council elections seem to confirm the division you predicted between London and the rest of the country.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there's some sort of hesitancy there, I would say, which is it's kind of technical and a bit frustrating. Which is the last time those seats were contested was in 2018. Now, that was 1 year before the collapse of what we call the Red Wall, which is this sort of post-industrial northern towns used to support Labour, were lured over, seduced to the Conservatives by sort of socially conservative views, by the Brexit narrative. So it's not really a comparison of like with like. Really, what Labour needed to do to demonstrate that it could take those seats back, and it has to take those seats back if it's going to win a general election, is that it could stand still in them. That was all it needed to do. They didn't need to retake anything. It just needed to stand still. Because if it was performing in those seats as it was in 2018, a year before its disastrous defeat and its plunge in the polls, it suggests that it can take back the Red Wall when it challenges at the next general election. Now, that's what they did. So actually, what you've seen there is it's not like suddenly those sort of those towns, often, you know, compared to London, to the great metropolitan sort of metropolitan areas, it's been much more socially conservative. It's not like Labour's suddenly taking them back. But what it is doing is it's showing consistent improvement in its polling among that electorate. And if it manages to continue doing that at the moment, I mean, the odds on are for Labour not to have a majority, but for the Labour leader to become the next Prime Minister, to do better than the Tory party. At the moment, that's where the polls are. That's what most of the suggestions are from academics looking at the data. So they're currently on course, although it's not exactly a very inspiring sort of high-flowing Blairite sort of performance, but they're doing pretty well.
Now, we may be separated by a vast distance, Ian, but you and I are one with our enthusiasm for the monarchy. So I want you to tell me about the tradition of the Queen's speech and the rather interesting difference with the latest.
Yeah, I mean, the core difference is that Prince Charles did it and not the Queen. So the Queen's speech is where you lay out the government's agenda, and it's this extremely tedious, pompous ceremony where the Queen comes into Parliament, Black Rod, the sort of parliamentary official with, you know, a typically insane name, knocks on the door of the Commons. The Commons shuts the door in his face to demonstrate their superiority to the monarchy. And then they march over to the Lords to hear her read out this speech, which is in fact written by the government. Beg your pardon. Which is in fact written by the government as to what bills they're going to pass. Now, she wasn't there this time. Apparently, she still has health concerns, and it was taken over by Prince Charles.
I thought she was there symbolically in that there was a crown on a velvet cushion.
Oh, God, yes, I forgot the absurdities of what we went through. Yes, next to you're quite right. Next to Prince Charles, there is a velvet cushion with a crown on it. I have to tell you, representing the Queen, at the end of the speech, the crown was then driven away in a special crown car. I'd love to tell you that I'm making any of this up, but I can assure you that I'm not. I don't know whether the crown car was specially designed for this purpose or whether they just got any old car and chucked it in there. But nevertheless,
I've got to be careful here. We're talking crown car, not clown car.
Well, you can take your pick, really. There's also, of course, the double symbolism that Prince Charles is there. Now, the last time any monarch with the name of Charles went into Parliament was King Charles I.
We know what happened then, don't we?
Yes. Well, it didn't work out very well for him. In fact, it ended up with him getting his head chopped off. So it's a wonder as you look at him, you sort of look at Prince Charles II, as he will later be called, and sort of think, well, I wonder whether you're going to be any more cautious than your namesake was. The bills themselves were predictably terrible. The best ones were sort of vacuous, and you sort of thought, well, this probably won't do any damage. The worst ones had a kind of Belarusian tinge of severe authoritarian government.
Well, Dominic Raab's bit caused you particular concern, didn't it?
Oh, it was just the most sort of infantile gibberish. We have in this country the Human Rights Act, which takes the Strasbourg sort of convention, European Convention of Human Rights, and imposes it in British law. It's very, very, I mean, it's one of the great liberal accomplishments of the post-war period. Dominic Raab, the Justice Secretary, has been trying to get rid of it for most of his career, and his plan to do so is to introduce something called a British Bill of Rights. The first Bill of Rights was during the Glorious Revolution and created rights for the individual. Dominic Raab is the first person, as far as I can tell, in the history of ideas who's ever proposed a Bill of Rights whose main intention is to take rights away from the individual. Talking about balancing with democracy, with public sense of outrage, you know, people's rights and their responsibilities. And then, in a telling phrase, how would we decide what rights people have? Well, it will be left up to common sense. That's a direct quote, common sense. Now, common sense, of course, doesn't have any legal meaning. And what we presume it means, I mean, no one of any kind of intellectual standing whatsoever would use that phrase when actually proposing something in legislation. What we presume it means is whatever Dominic Raab thinks it means. And in fact, there you have statutory instrument powers. These are the little powers of ministers they can use without any kind of scrutiny from the Commons in order to start messing around with Britain's legislative structure.
And you feel that other legislation is pretty much equally badly drafted?
Oh, it's very bad. I mean, to the point where I actually spent some of last week sitting down looking at one clause in a Michael Gove-authored bill on levelling up with several lawyers as they tried to work out what it meant. And by the end of the discussion, you know, one of the lawyers was just like, I just don't think this means anything. Like, no one could find any substance to it at all. The clause concerns something called street votes, which was briefed to the press as you will be able to vote as a street on whether your neighbour should be able to get their extension or not. Now, it's exactly the kind of just populist gibberish that you would expect from the government, but of course raises the quite troubling prospect that, you know, the wealthy, well-to-do family that maybe everyone aspires towards having their curtains, they get their ascension passed, but the solitary guy who everyone thinks is a bit weird, or the foreigner, or the person with a different skin colour, or the lesbian couple, or maybe from the curtain twitchers, will think, well, we're not going to let them have their extension. Of course, this is all there, but when you try to assess the legislation and see whether that's really a genuine danger or not, it's almost impossible, because the writing of the bill itself lacks any kind of concrete meaning whatsoever.
We're hearing the righteous indignation of Ian Dunt, who is, of course, a columnist with the I newspaper and author of that splendid tome, How to Be a Liberal. Now, our government and yours may be separated by vast distances, but by golly, they think along similar lines. Yours has announced cutting public service positions, as indeed ours threatens to do.
Yeah, it's this constant attack on the civil service by the Tory government here. I mean, here they're looking to cut it down by around a quarter, I mean, 91,000 positions. There's an irony to this, of course, which is that they have grown the civil service at quite extraordinary speeds, mostly because they needed lots of people in there to deliver Brexit. Brexit was a very, very hard, technical, painstaking thing to do. And they absolutely stuffed it full of civil servants, and most importantly, promised them rapid succession up the ranks if they would go do Brexit. They had to do that, because most civil servants thought, I don't really want to have any part of that at all, please, mate. They really had to be bribed into doing it. Now, after a couple of years of abuse, they're deciding to get rid of them. There is a reason that governments like this always hate the civil service, which is the civil service, one of their roles is to sit there and go, you know what, you can't actually do that. That's not strictly legal, or that won't really work for these reasons, or you haven't followed sort of due process on equality legislation, for instance. And this government, more than any, really hates that kind of voice in the room. And this seems like
over a long period in this country, public servants have been replaced by, by advisors, by political advisors.
Oh, yeah, we have the same thing here. We call them SPADs, special advisors. The fascinating thing about SPADs, by the way, is constitutionally you can use them for whatever you want. You know, so you could get a SPAD in, you can bring them into the Treasury, to the Ministry of Justice, and you could pick someone with expertise. You could pick someone with 30 years of expertise in an area who could scrutinise the kind of thing you were doing, stress test it, make sure it would work in practice. Do they ever do that? Absolutely they do not. What they bring in are political appointees who are there to advise the minister on the likely political damage or advantage they would get from a policy, a very different criteria for evaluating whether it would be legitimate or useful. So yeah, we have the same thing, and they're used in the most sort of petty, poverty-stricken way you can imagine.
So we can end our conversation on a lighter note. I understand that Keir Starmer has been caught up in something called Beergate.
Yes, Keir Starmer is involved in a scandal which involves the fact that he eats food. This was a retaliatory attack for the Boris Johnson Partygate story, mostly from the Daily Mail, which for 13 straight days ran pictures of Starmer. It's a very right-wing newspaper trying to get him under investigation by the police. They are now investigating it. I have to say, on the contents of the case, he has nothing to answer, but he has now stated if they find against him, he will step down as leader of the Labour Party.
Ian, I'm delighted that you're back in our studio, and thanks for your wonderful contribution. You have, as you know, a considerable following in the Antipodes. Ian Dunt, columnist with the I newspaper.
Getting in touch with ABCRN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.